the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, we've all heard about how to stay healthy and avoid contacting COVID-19. We hear about wearing masks, about washing your hands, and maintaining social distancing. But what about diet? Could diet actually help us avoid COVID-19 or a healthy immune system? Joining me on the program is Dr. Brett Shear. He's a doctor, board-certified cardiologist, and a lipidologist, and he specializes in a lot of patients working from heart disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and insulin resistance. So, doctor, I guess the first thing I want to start out is we all know that we've been told, wear a mask, wash your hands, maintain social distancing. Let's talk about diet and how important a healthy diet in boosting that immune system can help us either avoiding COVID-19 or if we contact it and get it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity to speak on this topic because it's so important right now for so many people. And, you know, I wrote this article on Diet Doctor titled Boosting Your Immune System to Fight the Coronavirus, What You Need to Know. And in reality, the term is sort of misleading, right? Boosting your immune system. There's no magic food out there that's going to boost your immune system and help you fight infections. But the key is not being sick is what helps you fight infections, is what helps you not get infections or not have complications. And so what do I mean by being sick? Well, it really comes down to, it looks like a lot of it can come down to metabolic health. Obviously, if people are immunosuppressed for whatever reason, meaning their immune system is chronically lowered either from a medication they take or from an inherent condition that they were basically born with, or an autoimmune condition or cancer or something like that. But for the majority of us, it comes down to being as healthy as you can be and not being sick, because the people who have the biggest problem with severe complications from COVID-19 are the people who have, we've heard it over and over again, comorbid conditions. And those tend to be high blood pressure, diabetes. Now there's evidence that any elevated blood glucose, even in the absence of diabetes, can cause it. And it all hints at this underlying cause of metabolic disease, metabolic dysfunction, where insulin levels are high and our bodies are insulin resistant. And so I think the key to helping you stay healthy, either from potentially not getting the infection or more likely not getting a complication from the infection, is to make sure your metabolic health is as good as it can be. So then the question becomes, what can we do in our lifestyle to promote that? And diet plays a crucial, crucial role in that. So when it comes to, you know, boosting your immune system, I'm more a fan of boosting your health in general. Now's a time more than ever that we need to pay attention to our metabolic health to lower our risk of complication from COVID-19.
You know, we've heard doctor mentioned, you know, for years, take vitamin C, it helps avoiding colds. Take vitamin D, there's essential oils, there's silver nanoparticles. What about these things in aiding and making for a stronger immune system?
Yeah, good questions. So first of all, you know, we have to be honest that the evidence that we're talking about is fairly poor quality. And what I mean by poor quality is, you know, how do you define immune system? If you define, you know, benefiting your immune system by what one type of infection fighting cell does in your body, okay, you can prove different supplements may have an effect on that. But what you really care about, what you care about, what I care about, is are you going to get an infection or not? Not necessarily what your immune cells do, because the immune system is, as it says, it's a system. It's this complex constellation of different systems working together, different cells working together. So that's where the evidence is kind of low. But the best evidence we have is vitamin C, vitamin D, maybe even zinc can help decrease risk of infection or decrease duration of symptomatic infections in terms of, you know, influenza, common cold. What this means for COVID-19, we don't know, but we sort of have to extrapolate. And so the best evidence seems to be for most people, obviously not for everybody, and you always have to check with your own doctor before starting anything, but it seems like vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc probably have the best evidence behind them. But again, the most important thing is going back to lifestyle in general, because if you're, you know, eating lots of junk and sweets and lots of refined carbohydrates and packaged foods and processed foods, and thinking you're going to undo all that damage by taking some vitamin C or vitamin D, you're really barking up the wrong tree there, because that's not the place to start. The place to start is making sure you're eating whole foods, minimally processed, lower carb, you know, natural foods, lots of vegetables, lots of clean animal products, making sure your metabolic health is low, that you're not overtaxing your glucose and insulin regulatory systems. Make sure you're getting lots of sleep and managing your stress. Those are the places to start. And then if you want to add to that, then you can start thinking about vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, along those lines. But it really all comes back to, what are you doing with your lifestyle? Because it is a little, not a little, it's quite misleading to think that any these supplements are going to undo an unhealthy lifestyle.
Yeah, because just going over the statistics that have been reported on the morbidity rates, it seems like a lot of the patients that have died from COVID-19 have had comorbidities, whether it's heart disease, cancer, autoimmune disease, diabetes, those kind of symptoms, and younger people, vaping, obesity, those kind of things. And they have found, at least maybe you can speak to this, that the younger folks that are in good shape health-wise have had less of the symptoms. In fact, many might have had it and not even known about it.
Yeah, I think in general, that does appear to be very accurate from the data we're seeing. Now, of course, that doesn't mean young, healthy people with no problems are completely immune to having severe complications, because there have been some very tragic reports, whether it's on Twitter or social media or whatever, of people who fit the criteria who have died or had severe complications. So it's not that it's an all or none, but certainly the percentages are very heavily weighed towards people with diabetes, people with high blood pressure, people who are obese. And I suspect that is more of a marker of underlying metabolic dysfunction that just wasn't measured or looked for. And of course, age is something you can't control. That's the biggest risk factor of all. Being over 75 is the biggest, and the next is being over 65. But of the metabolic conditions, those are completely within our control. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, high blood sugar, even with or without diabetes, which to me means it's a marker of insulin resistance, underlying metabolic disease. Now, we also don't know that if you improve your health tomorrow or next week that you reduce your risk, but sure, it sure makes sense that you should. That you should at least try and do your best, because what's the best way to prevent complications is to not have those comorbidities in the first place. So that's why I think it's so important now for people to really pay attention to their lifestyles now more than ever. And we've written quite a lot about this on dietdoctor.com, about what the risk factors are and about what you can do to try and control those risk factors. And we have to be honest with ourselves that we don't have intervention trials to show that low-carb eating is going to reduce your risk. But it just makes so much sense that if you can do whatever you can to control your blood sugar, it should control your risk. Sometimes we just have to go with what makes sense, especially when the risk is so high and the cost is so little for taking control of your health and managing your metabolic health and really making it a priority.
Now, you've been a big fan of low-carb diets, ketogenic-type diets. What has been your experience with these kind of diets, dealing with the kind of diseases that you deal with on a daily basis? Cardiovascular disease, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, autoimmune disease. What has been the experience in your practice?
Yeah, the experience has been life-changing for me as well as my patients. Unfortunately, as a doctor, I was never really taught about a ketogenic diet or low-carb diet. This was something I had to discover on my own, and I was lucky enough to be working with a health coach who knew a lot about it to help it start me down the path of him educating me and then educating myself. And, you know, diseases like type 2 diabetes or metabolic syndrome that were basically taught as being chronic progressive diseases that you can try and manage but are eventually going to progress and worsen are now completely reversible. And they really always have been reversible, but we never really saw it in that way. You know, never in my career did I ever take anybody off diabetes medications or insulin. It was always just trying to help the primary care doctor or the endocrinologist manage the disease by increasing the medication, trying to get people to focus on lifestyle, but realizing, you know, they were going to need medications the rest of their lives. But making the transition to low-carb and keto, that changed dramatically. Now, all of a sudden, people are getting off their diabetes medications. People who with metabolic syndrome are never progressing to type 2 diabetes. And people are really revolutionizing their lives from this because of the freedom of not needing these medications, just the cost alone, and then now knowing that they can be proactive and improve their health. And just because they were given this diagnosis of type 2 diabetes doesn't condemn them to a life of this disease with the complications of kidney failure and blindness and heart attacks. And it doesn't have to be that way. And for me, low carb has been the best intervention to see this happen. Now, you know, not everybody can completely get off their medication. Some people are going to still need a combination of lifestyle medications, but anything that controls that blood sugar and lowers the insulin is the key. And low carb sure does that, because so many of our medications can control blood sugar, but they increase insulin. And that's where I think we have the paradigm wrong. It's not just a blood sugar condition for diabetes or for prediabetes and metabolic syndrome. It's a blood sugar and an insulin condition with our insulin levels being too high. So the best treatments are those that are going to address the blood sugar level and the insulin level. And low carb does that better than any lifestyle I've seen.
Now, other things that we've been told, you know, we've all been told numerous times about proper hand washing. Obviously, don't smoke, get adequate sleep. When you're talking about smoking, are you talking about cigarettes, vaping? What about an occasional cigar?
Good question. Well,
I selfishly asked that.
well, look, I'm going to be completely honest. When it comes to COVID-19, I have no idea. When it comes to COVID-19 infections, I have no idea. I actually saw something recently showing smokers had decreased risk of lung troubles with COVID-19, which makes no sense to me. I need to dig into that a little bit more, but I think we don't have enough information about that. When it comes to general health, look, tobacco, cigarettes are one of the worst things you can do for your life, not just for your lungs, other types of cancer besides lung cancer, and of course, cardiovascular disease. So obviously you want to stop that. And if COVID-19 is your reason for doing it, by all means do it. Because if you get put on a ventilator and your lung function is compromised to begin with from smoking, you know, you're in big, big trouble. You know, vaping, you know, there's that recent rash of people dying from vaping because of the chemicals and the irritants in it. So is that worth it? Cigars, you know, less of a trouble with your lungs, but you know, it's not a free ride. You get oral cancers from cigars as well, and in the mouth and the mucosa and even esophageal. So, you know, you got to pick your poison, so to speak. And there are lots of things that people do that are not good for them. But if I was to rank them, it certainly would be tobacco the worst, then vaping, then cigars. And, you know, if you have 5 cigars a day, that's different than 1 cigar a month when you play golf with your buddies. So you've got to pick what works for you. But in a perfect world, nobody would do any of those.
One I was really surprised in reading in your article is the right amount of exercise. You know, a cardiologist will tell you, and you're one, that if you have high blood pressure, half an hour of cardio a day. But you said that studies have shown that strenuous exercise, like an hour and a half a day, there's studies where these elite athletes that overtrain tend to suffer from infections. Explain that. What is the right amount of exercise?
That's a great question. And exercise is one of those things that is great for you, but doesn't necessarily fit the criteria of more is better. So when you talk about Ironman triathletes or ultra endurance runners, or, you know, the Olympic cross-country skiers, that sort of the people who train the longest and the hardest, that has nothing to do with health. That's on a different level, right? They're not doing that for their health. They're doing that to scratch their competitive itch and because they love doing it. And I know I'm a former triathlete, and I did it because I had to do it. There was something in me that had to do it. But that's not health. Health is really moderate exercise and a mix of cardiovascular and resistance training. So how do you define moderate? And especially in the time of worrying about your immune function, because overtraining and sort of extreme training, so to speak, can acutely lower immune function. So back to the question, how do you define moderate? Well, it's going to be different for everybody, but you know, you can do it by heart rate, staying kind of below that 85% of your maximum predicted heart rate, you know, keeping it exercise around an hour, not much more. If you're doing resistance training, it's okay to train muscles to fatigue, but not to sort of whole body fatigue. And keeping tabs on sort of your energy level, your recovery, making sure for every moderate to hard workout, you get a recovery day. You know, these are the concepts that are important to keep in mind to avoid overtraining and to avoid overdoing it. If you're going to get out and walk for half an hour every day, that's perfectly fine. You know, it's hard to overtrain doing that. But at the same time, if you're the type of person who previously walked to the fridge from your couch and that's all you've ever done, then maybe walking a half an hour is going to be strenuous for you. So it does have to be, you do have to sort of take into mind where you're starting from. But the concept is keep it moderate, especially if you're worried about your overall immune function. But make sure you're staying active and doing something.
Some other things that help to make for a healthy body and immune system: stress management. Obviously, if you're stressed out over the stock market or procuring a roll of toilet paper and maybe now beef, that's probably not a good thing. And there's things that we can do from meditation to relaxation techniques. So that's one. The other one that you talked about, and I've heard so many stories about this, and that's alcohol. Like, for example, you know, the French have been drinking wine for centuries, and they don't have the heart disease and diabetes issues that we have. What is a moderate, or what's a good level of alcohol, or should you be even having alcohol, I guess, is a question.
Yeah, so if you're not an alcohol drinker, now is not the time to start, although I think a lot of people probably are, just to manage the stress. But that's so temporary when it comes to managing stress. That's not the healthiest way to manage your stress, for sure. But now is not the time to start drinking alcohol. If you already are a drinker, then, you know, two drinks for men, one drink for women is what's always thrown around. And, you know, that's everybody's best guess. It has more to do with sort of weight and your tolerance and genetics, and there's so many different things that go into it, but that's what's generally thrown around as a moderate amount. And there is some evidence that, you know, heavy drinking can acutely depress your immune system, whether it's alcoholics or people who go on binges, you know, maybe more likely to get infections. So that is something to definitely be cautious of. So, you know, I think the key is learning what's moderate for you, not getting drunk. Having one or two drinks is okay. Beyond that, you're starting to toe the line of risk-reward, maybe tilting out of your favor.
Now, let's talk about supplements. We started our conversation talking about vitamin C, D. In your article, you talk about C, D, zinc, and turmeric. Let's talk about those, and what do they aid, or what do they enhance in the immune system?
Yeah. Well, so turmeric, I guess there's no convincing evidence that it's going to help fight a viral infection. But there's some weak evidence that it may improve immune function, this what's called interleukin 10. But here's the thing, something like turmeric, I think, is a perfect example. What's the downside of taking turmeric? You know, adding it to your food or taking a curcumin supplement, you know, there's very little downside to that. So I can't stand here and say it's going to dramatically improve your immune function, but it's one of those things that's got such little downside, especially since it's a common spice that many people like to eat. So I encourage people to use turmeric on their food. I think that can be helpful. You know, same thing for garlic. You know, there's some suggestion that maybe garlic is helpful. And again, the evidence is so poor to see if it's really going to be beneficial and at what dose. So I don't recommend people go out and start pounding garlic pills, but if you like garlic in your food, use it. It's not going to hurt, and it certainly could be beneficial. And I know these answers aren't sort of the sexy, catchy, headline-gripping answers, but I think we have to be honest about the strength of our evidence. Just because there's one study that shows, you know, garlic or curcumin can do something to your immune system, by no means does that mean we should run out and start promoting it as something that's amazing for your immune system. But it all comes down to, you know, risk versus benefit. And the risks of these are incredibly low for most people. So if the benefit's even a small benefit, then maybe it's worth it. Yeah, but again, it's not going to undo the unhealthy lifestyle. It's not going to undo the poor nutrition with the highly processed and packaged foods and the refined carbohydrates. None of this is going to undo that. That's where people need to focus first.
And then you also talk about nutrition, the importance of fruit, veggies, and seeds having adequate phytonutrients. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, phytonutrients is such a buzzword. Phytonutrients are present in fruits and veggies, but here's the thing, we have no idea if we actually need them. We have no idea if that's actually what helps. You know, it's the same thing with antioxidants. You know, more importantly than getting antioxidants is avoiding the prooxidants, I would say. So again, it comes down to if you're eating well, if you're eating whole foods, minimally processed, chances are you're not going to need antioxidants and phytonutrients. But you know, where are these phytonutrients found? Well, they're found in most of the vegetables. And so that seems easy enough that you should be eating your fresh vegetables to whether it's because of the phytonutrients or maybe it's just the fiber, we don't know. And that's where I think when people throw around terms like you need to get adequate phytonutrients, we have no idea what that means. We have to be honest about that. We have no idea what an adequate amount of phytonutrients is. But it comes down to eating, you know, fresh, real, whole food. And I think that's the key. We can't say that fruits and phytonutrients are magical for your immune system. We just don't have that evidence. And the same for like refined carbohydrates and sugars, we can be pretty confident that those are deleterious. And if we're avoiding those, then maybe we don't need to add extra things. Because some people want to take extra phytonutrient pills or antioxidant pills or, you know, blueberry extract type pills. You know, again, it just comes down to be reasonable about what you're eating. And you probably don't need that stuff. It's probably not going to add very much. And when we talk about immune system, immune function, with COVID-19, there's more than just immune function, because there's also the inflammatory response to your body. And blood sugar seems to play a big part of that. And that's where really avoiding the refined carbohydrates and the sugars, I think, is going to make its biggest impact.
And a final question before we summarize, what is it about ibuprofen that they recommend you don't take?
You know, there were some, sort of in the beginning, some of the first evidence we had of the infection complications, people were reporting that some of the most severe cases came in taking ibuprofen. But this is classic observational evidence. You know, well, does that mean the ibuprofen caused the problem, or is it just, you know, the more severe cases had a higher fever, so they were more likely to be taking ibuprofen, or they had more severe muscle aches, so they were more likely to be taking ibuprofen? We don't know, but it was enough of a concern in the beginning of the infection to say, well, hey, maybe we should be taking acetaminophen instead for fever and for muscle aches instead of ibuprofen, just in case there is a relationship there. You know, I haven't heard much about that lately. That was sort of in the early stages. I haven't heard as much about that lately. So I've got to be honest, I don't know where it stands, but I would still recommend probably acetaminophen as a first line. And then if symptoms are bad enough, going to ibuprofen. But you also have to remember that the fever isn't the problem, right? The fever can make you uncomfortable, but the fever is your body's natural response to fight the infection. So there are some who believe any treating a fever at all is misguided and we should let the fever go to a degree, right? Anything above 104 can actually start to cause some damage. And it's pretty miserable when you have that high fever. But there's, you know, there's some opinion that a fever of 101, 102 doesn't require medication to suppress it and probably should not be suppressing it. We don't have clear data one way or the other, but it's certainly an interesting theory. And that's where, you know, you really have to focus on hydration, making sure you're getting your electrolytes in, making sure you're doing anything else you can to stay comfortable, you know, whether it's cold compresses or just making sure you're getting lots of rest and lots of hydration. Those are the most important parts.
So in summing up, we've told about, you know, wearing a mask, good hand hygiene, social distancing. So if I was to sum up, basically trying to create a healthy body and immune system, eating a nutritious diet that minimizes high blood sugar, prioritizing restful sleep, managing stress, don't smoke or stop smoking, moderate exercise, and getting plenty of sunshine and fresh air. Anything I'm leaving out?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's a great start. It doesn't have to be all that complicated, but it does have to be a lifestyle priority. Kind of take good care of yourself, take care of your metabolic health, and hopefully reduce your risk of any complications.
All right, Doctor. Well, listen, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your podcast, The Diet Doctor?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that opportunity. So I'm the medical director at dietdoctor.com, and we're the number one low-carb website in the world right now with lots of free information about how to go low-carb, how to make it simple. And we have a podcast that you can find through any of the usual podcast mediums and on YouTube, where we talk about all the topics that are important to low-carb and to health in general. And then in addition to that, we just have so many other resources on our website, a lot recently about COVID-19 and the risk factors and how metabolic health plays into that. And then a lot about just the health benefits of low-carb and how to get started.
All right. And give that out one more time, if you would.
Dietdoctor.com is the best place to go to get started.
All right. Well, Doctor, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that information. Once again, just staying healthy. It was kind of nice to hear that you don't have to be a gym rat and exercise an hour, hour and a half a day. Eat natural foods, unprocessed foods, a healthy diet, get lots of sunshine, exercise, and, well, a lot of this simply is just pure common sense. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.